Hey, do you remember Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Hello, and welcome to Hey, Do You Remember?, a show where we reminisce about a movie or TV series we grew up with, then take off the rose-tinted glasses to see how it holds up today. I'm Chris.
I'm Donna.
And I'm Carlos.
And today we're revisiting Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. A crime wave has hit New York City, and intrepid reporter April O'Neil seems to be the only one brave enough to investigate its connections to an ancient criminal organization known as the Foot. April gets in over her head, but fortunately, some unlikely allies come to her aid. Four talking turtles who live in the city's sewer with their mentor, Splinter. When the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic book hit shelves in 1984, its creators could not possibly have foreseen how successful this property would become. From the late 80s to mid-90s, it was nothing short of a pop culture phenomenon, a movement which was spearheaded by the original Saturday morning cartoon, which ran from 1987 to 1996. So in 1990, the Turtles were arguably at their apex. Their brand had infiltrated every medium, every conceivable level of merchandising. And that spring, fans came out in droves for the Turtles' most highly anticipated adventure yet, their first live-action movie. Donna, what do you remember about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Well, I have to say, I remember loving this movie. You know that was coming.
Yeah. I think most of our listeners know that that's coming. I remember loving it.
I asked my brother, met Donna in person once, and he goes, "Is this the one who always grew up loving this movie?"
That's me. but I did. It's true. It was a wonderful motion picture. And I recently spoke to my dad about it. And, you know, in doing this podcast, when he was talking about, he took me to see it when I was eight years old when this came out. Mm-hmm. And the way he put it was, of all the things that you would have shown me to ask me if my 8-year-old little girl is going to be into this, if you showed me this, I'd be like, absolutely not. No. But she loved it. So
that's awesome.
My dad took me to see the Ninja Turtles. And I didn't even really, I don't know, I just always watched it. Like, I'm sure you guys did too. It was just such a normal, they were awesome. I didn't even think about the fact that they were doing the ninjing, but they were. And this is probably the first instance where I really liked a movie with fighting.
Oh.
So.
Yeah. Ninja there is a lot of ninjaing awesome. In this one.
There's so much ninjaing.
There's less ninjaing as they go on, but this one has a
true.
Ton of it.
I feel like I see them get tired sometimes. The suits have to be heavy.
This is a lot of ninjaing, you guys.
They just breathe.
Give me 10.
But, yeah, what a great thing. And it's funny. It's amazing listening to you talk about it and realizing how big it is and still continues to be is kind of wild.
Were you into the cartoon as well?
Yeah, I watched the cartoon. I loved Saturday morning cartoons. Whatever you had, I was going to watch it. And so this was definitely on the docket.
Who is your favorite turtle?
My favorite turtle, I'm so glad you asked, probably Leonardo.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
He has double swords, and he's a really good leader.
Double swords, sure, yes.
Yeah.
That definitely goes in the plus column.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Carlos, what do you remember?
I remember loving this movie. I remember the first time I ever heard about Ninja Turtles. It was like my friend's mother was talking to my mom and was just saying, "Oh, my kids are really into this Ninja Turtles thing." And my mom's like, "Oh, we'd never heard of that because I was into like Ghostbusters or whatever."
Yeah.
And I just remember immediately picturing like live action, like pet turtles with bandanas because the mom had explained that they wore different color bandanas. And I was like, that sounds really dumb. But then, and then I watched it and I was like, this is amazing. I had the action figures, which my mom tells me now, She's like, I feel like I was more excited about collecting the action figures than you were, because for you as a child, like, you just got them as gifts. Like, I had to go out to the stores and find them. Oh, and, yeah. Like, you know, and like, track down, you know, the missing whatever piece that you needed. So it became a thing for parents. But, yeah, I definitely took the playset to the Ghostbusters. So it was like a firehouse.
Oh, sure. And yeah, I had that.
Turned it on its side, so it was horizontal now, and I turned that into, like, the underground lair
for
the Ninja Turtles, because I didn't have the sewer lair.
Right.
Yeah,
that's very creative.
Yeah, I was very creative. I could never figure that out now. But then when I saw the movie, I just remember going, like, well, this, you know, why is there no Krang? And why is there no Dimension X? And, like, I was kind of thrown off by the lack of cartoony sci-fi-ness of it, but I still loved it. I still thought this was, you know, a totally legit thing. I just thought it was, I just, like, it was the first time I had ever accepted that there had to be differences for the movie adaptation, basically.
Okay.
So yeah, I was like, oh, okay, well, I mean, no Krang. That's weird. He's kind of integral to the show, but,
you know, that's interesting, because, like, this is maybe, you know, because Batman came out the year before this, but when you think of something like Batman, for us, we were, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, whatever it was. But, I mean, for a lot of kids our age, that was the introduction to that character.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start – then a cartoon comes out, and then more movies start coming out or whatever. But this – yeah, you're right. We had the cartoon first. So this was maybe one of the first times we went into something with those sort of expectations about what we were going to see, and just what you said, the difference in mediums and the changes they had to make, and for us to, like, reconcile those. This was maybe one of the earliest instances of that happening.
And it's probably, I mean, I've never, this is going to be, I'm losing my geek card. I've never read the comic books, so it might be just a really close adaptation to the comic books that I don't know about.
It actually is, yeah. Yeah, the plot is, yeah.
Totally. Yeah, in retrospect, I mean, that makes a ton of sense. But I only knew it as a cartoon. I didn't know it was a comic book until years later.
Right, which I think is the same boat most of us were in. Or even if we were aware of the comic book, that was not something – if you were a good parent, your kid was not reading that comic book. It was crazy violent. So, like, that – yeah, I think for most of us, that's how we define the Turtles, is through that cartoon. Or it was until this movie came out.
I remember being really mad that April worked at the wrong news station.
Channel 6, not Channel 3.
I was like, wait, what? Why would you change that? That doesn't make any sense. Just keep it.
Well, so I also remember loving this movie. And speaking of the toys, it just so my parents, my grandparents, they hated these fucking things, because it was one of those situations where it's like, you have 7 Michelangelos. Why do you need this one? Because this one, the shell opens up and you can store shit in it. It's different. I need it. It's like, it drove them crazy. And but so there are 2 images that always come to mind when I think about the build-up to this film. The first is a still photo that showed up in Nintendo Power, where it was like some kid brought it into school, my friend Mike, and he was like, have you guys seen this? And he flips it open, and it was like, holy shit, it's Donatello fighting a member of the Foot Clan, but it was obscured by a lot of smoke and you couldn't see very much. It was just this incredible tease that, holy fuck, the Turtles are in live action. And the other image is that first teaser poster with them peeking out of the sewer, and all you see are their eyes and the bandanas. And I feel pretty lucky that I grew up in an era where the filmmakers and the marketing departments still had some level of control over what an audience knew about a movie, you know, before they head into the theater. Because I went into this pretty blind. I had not gotten a good look at the Turtles yet. I hadn't seen a single picture of Shredder. I didn't know anything about the plot. I basically just knew it was called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and that's all I needed to know. But you know, this thing was so massive. This was another one like Home Alone, where it's one of the first movies I remember being aware of selling out like crazy, like just knowing that we might not get in to see it. And so a weekend show, that was out of the question. It was just – it was going to be impossible. My mom knew it. But she also knew I was dying to see this. So she got home from work one day and said she had a surprise. And she got me and my sister into the car. And as soon as we turned onto 75th Street, because that's where the two big theaters were at the time, I just knew. I was like, oh, my God, tonight's the night. And as we pulled into the parking lot, she said – now, Chris, I don't want you to get too excited. Like, we still might not get in. But it was too late. Like, of course, I was bouncing off the fucking walls. And I was, like, in total suspense as we got up to that ticket counter and she asked for three tickets. And just that sweet sound of the tickets printing. Like, God, I remember that so vividly. And the smile on my mom's face as she handed me my ticket. And so we sat down. The movie started. And I had this thing when I was a kid, like sometimes I'd get so happy and overjoyed by stuff and I wouldn't know how to express it. The same thing happened when I saw Batman, actually, where I couldn't communicate my gratitude or love of what I was seeing. And so I would I would just start crying. Like all these emotions are just like one way or another, we're busting out of here, buddy. And so I did. I cried, like right at the opening where April's giving her news report about this crime wave. And you're seeing all these shots of that stuff. And then, you know, the kids running into that warehouse. Like, and that's the part that got me. And I think of it every time I see this, where they slide under that fence and they're running to the warehouse and the music really kicks in. And I remember thinking, God, this is nothing like the cartoon. This is a real movie. They're doing it right. And yeah, I was so happy. I just cried, like before the turtles even showed up on screen. And so needless to say, I loved it so much, in fact, that I don't even care that Michael Bay's doing this new one. I don't care if it sucks, because this is my Ninja Turtles movie. I will always have this and all these amazing memories of seeing it for the first time and just being totally enthralled by it. And with that said, we just looked at Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles with fresh eyes. So let's see how it holds up. The first thing I want to do is actually plug one of our previous episodes, because if you haven't listened to our discussion of Super Mario Brothers, this movie came up a lot. So if you want to hear more of our thoughts on this film, especially what we think makes it such a great adaptation, be sure and download that one. And if you have heard it already, I want to apologize if some of this gets redundant. I did my best to avoid taking notes that were covering too much of the same ground, but I think it's probably inevitable. There might be a little crossover here. So, but yeah, so like I mentioned, it starts with April's news report about the crime wave that has hit New York. And to this day, I still love this for the same reason I did as a kid. This could be the intro of a Lethal Weapon sequel or something. Like, this is – it's a real city. It's dirty. It's dangerous. And the movie immediately sets itself apart from the other adaptations, and it lets you know that you're settling in for the most sincere Talking Turtles movie you're probably ever going to see.
It's the Citizen Kane of Talking Turtles movies.
That's clear. The absolute truth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, well, it's a great hybrid of the comic book and the cartoon while simultaneously being its own take on all of this as well. It's like, it's just this great mix of elements and tone. And I'm going to bring up in just a second about how it succeeded in having it both ways. But so after we see that intro, you're like, April's leaving the news station. They give a nice nod to the cartoon and the comics with her yellow raincoat.
Yeah.
I think as a kid, I was probably disappointed she wasn't in the full jumpsuit, but I realized that would have been ridiculous. So I also seem to remember I wasn't crazy about this actress at first. Like, I mean, now I think she's fine. She's great. And I like that the movie doesn't really have any name actors in it. I think Corey Feldman is the voice of Donatello is probably right. The biggest name at the time. And, you know, I'm sure that was a decision that was born out of necessity, but it winds up working in their favor. I mean, it helps you buy into all of this, which is pretty important with this sort of premise. The one thing I thought was kind of funny was that – so during that initial broadcast, April mentions that part of the reason these thieves have been so successful is that they're so fast. There haven't been any eyewitnesses. And then she steps out of the studio and it's like, oh, hi there. It's like, oh, shit. Like you got us. Yeah, just like, oh, damn.
Slowly taking TVs out of a van.
Right. And so, yeah, she stumbles across these thieves led by Sam Rockwell, by the way.
Yes.
And they tell her, you know, wrong place, wrong time. And just when it looks like she's done for, someone knocks out the streetlight and you hear these dudes getting their asses kicked. And this is definitely something that stuck with me the first time I saw it. The way they tease you a little bit before actually showing you the turtles, because they know that's what you came to see. So from there, we move into the opening credits. And I thought maybe for the first time that this theme feels a little out of place here,
least
in this one instance, because you get the dramatic prologue and then this intense action beat. And then it's da 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 da. Like, what happened here?
It's such a bad score. It's such a bad score.
I don't know that I'd say it's bad. And I think it fits in other places. It's just like I actually really like the score, like especially in those early moments. And Shredder's theme is really good, and everything with the Foot Clan is appropriately dramatic. It's just that abrupt shift from like da 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 da. Like, all right, fine.
Anytime that music, that particular like theme came up, I was like, this cannot be the best music they could find for this movie. Like, oh my, it's not Weekend at Bernie's, but it sounds like Weekend at Bernie's.
I thought it was like circusy. I was like, reminded me of like Pee Wee's Big Top. I was like, oh yeah, totally. We're gonna fight some guys and eat pizza. I thought it was.
That was the trailer.
Delightful.
Did you go to Bayside or Valley?
Well, you know what? I mean, forever. The turtle, Michelangelo at least, does have kind of a surfer thing.
Yeah. Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
So we see the shadows of the turtles on the walls of the sewer, and it's just more of like, you know, just come on, give me the money shot already. And then they do. Some dude just ejaculates under the camera lens. He uses his finger to write the words Ninja Turtles with it.
What does it mean?
What does it mean?
Sorry, guys. I was going through some shit. Steve Barron. And then they delay it even longer, because just when you think you're about to see one of them, the image freezes and you get the logo. And I remember thinking, wow, they even got the font right. Like, I'm sure I wasn't using the word font yet, but
right.
The logo's the one from the cartoon. So that was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And then we see the turtles for the first time. And if I'm being honest here, I'm not sure these costumes hold up as well as I'd remembered. I still think they're great. They're made by Jim Henson's Creature Shop. So, you know, the articulation and the faces is still really impressive, like the eyes in particular. It's really just the seams between the head and neck, or around some of the joints where they can be a little awkward. And the mouths rarely sync up with the dialogue, but you just sort of go
later
with
on
it.
Later on in the movie, when April's like, what's wrong? And Leonardo's like, splinter.
Where he all of a sudden slips into a Lorne Michaels impression.
It's splinter, actually.
But yeah, exactly. So they get to their lair, which is reminiscent enough of the one in the cartoon, but like the rest of the film, it's dark, it's dingy, and most importantly, lived in. Like, this whole world just looks so lived in. And if you look at the aesthetic and tone of the second one, which really was a response to complaints about this one being too dark, it's a pretty dramatic contrast. I'm not sure that this one gets enough credit for this. Maybe it does. It probably does. But just that moody, rainy, dirty atmosphere was such a great choice, especially when you consider that the cartoon was far and away more popular than the comics. I mean, when we think of Ninja Turtles, you know, like I said before, the way we define them, I bet 90% of that is coming from that first cartoon and not the comic book. So the fact that they didn't just try to duplicate what made that successful, is that's kind of interesting. And well, this is also where we see Splinter for the first time. And this is another interesting change, the decision to make him more frail than he was in the cartoon. And it makes him a little more endearing, and it sort of raises the stakes when he's kidnapped later on. So I really like that change as well. And we're also starting to see the different personalities of each turtle. And more than anything, we're seeing that they're still just kids. They're goofing off. They're excited that they, you know, they just kicked some ass. And this is what I was talking about when I said that they get to have it both ways. So, like, the look of this film, the plot, the crime wave, Shredder, all of that stuff, it's all handled very seriously. It's more in line with those original comics. In fact, every major story beat comes from the first few arcs in the comics. Really specific stuff. Raphael meeting Casey Jones, the fight at April's apartment, the retreat to the farm, and then the return to the city. That's all from the comic books.
That's awesome.
But the comic treated the turtles very differently. There were no jokes or puns or one-liners. There was no cowabunga or any of that stuff. The only joke was that it was all played so serious because it was intended as sort of a satire of some of the super melodramatic comics and characters that were getting really, really popular at that time. It was like the creator saying, you know, what if we did New Mutants or Ronin, but with talking turtles? Like, even the Foot Clan is a reference to the Hand, which is this order of mystical ninjas in the Marvel universe.
Right.
And so in the movie, you know, the turtles do get to be funny, and they're clearly more influenced by the cartoon version, the different color bandanas, eating pizza, cracking jokes. So the film lets the characters be silly and amusing while still taking the story very seriously. And that's really important because the sequels don't really nail that sweet spot. The second one probably wasn't trying to, but the third one seemed like it was, and the less said about that one, the better, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Let's pretend that didn't happen.
Let's talk about Raphael's disguise because he decides he needs to go out and blow off some steam, but obviously the world's not ready for giant talking turtles. So he throws on a trench coat and a hat. And I know they did this in the comics. They did it in the cartoon from time to time. But this is one of those elements that doesn't totally translate to live action. It's basically ludicrous, is what I'm saying.
Well, it's like it's a satirical move in the comic book because it's definitely a play on like Clark Kent put on glasses and sure. No one recognizes that he's Superman. Or, you know, in the cartoon, it was like the cartoon is some of the cheapest animation you'll find when you watch it again. Like, it's really lazy. And yeah. This was probably just like, yeah, that's easy enough. Give them a coat and some hats and
right.
let them go out there. So it's a play on both of them. But if you're playing it earnestly like this movie was, then yeah, this is like kind of rough, especially. Well, when he meets Casey Jones, like, this doesn't make sense at all.
No, no. Well, and while we're talking about turtles' disguises, why do they wear color-coded bandanas? Are they trying to protect their secret identities as giant turtles? And they never take them off. Like, even when they're not fighting crime, can they not tell each other apart without them?
In the comic book, they wear red, right? They all
right,
wear red.
All of them wear red.
And
yeah.
Actually, I owned the first Ninja Turtle Nintendo game. The cartridge,
right.
You know, the old NES, and it had the box art was Ninja Turtles, you know, just as we know them, but with all of their red bandanas. And I was like, oh, they made a mistake on the box
yes,
art. For
exactly.
This game.
I thought the same thing.
Yeah. But apparently it was just more based on the comic book than
right.
the cartoon. But, I think that was one of the things that the creator said that they actually liked from the cartoon was that they gave them different colors so that you could differentiate. Because that's got to be really hard in a comic book. Like, who is talking right now?
Well, that's the thing. Is like, the only thing that differentiates them in that case is their weapons. And
right.
I remember that was one of the criticisms of Ninja Turtles from parents and stuff was that a lot of them said, oh, they don't have personalities. They're defined by the weapons they use, which isn't totally true. But like, the other thing, though, the thing I always liked about the movies and the cartoon also, it wasn't just the color-coded bandanas. They're all a different shade of green. And and then the movies, they're not, you know, they're all the same color, but they do have different faces. You can tell them apart even without the color-coded bandanas.
Although Donatello and Michelangelo are really interchangeable in this movie.
I don't – not their faces. I don't
know.
No.
I mean like
personality-wise. You know
that's
why?
That's why I think they have a lot of scenes where they just kind of sit together and talk to each other.
It really
it's
is.
It's kind of the same thing.
Leo and Raph are they have the more interesting story for sure. The movie's more interested in them. And yeah, Donatello and Michelangelo are sort of relegated to just the comic relief. And I think part of the problem is, so that's Michelangelo's role in the cartoon. And I mean, that's what he is. For Donatello, I think part of the problem is there's just not a lot of tech in this movie. And he was the tech guy. He's the one that built the turtle van and all of their gadgets and stuff. And there are shades of that in here, but it's not like we get to see more of nerdy scientist Donatello in the next movie, actually.
Right.
But anyways, well, so here's the thing about the trench coats and stuff. Okay, so the idea that the turtles are saving people but don't get to take credit for it is interesting. The fact that they're protecting a world that they don't get to be a part of, you can do more with that. And when you get down to it, the only reason Raphael has to go above ground here is so he can meet Casey Jones, a character who, if I'm being honest, I don't think even needs to be in this movie. And before everyone goes crazy, I like Casey Jones. I like Elias Codiez, the actor who plays him, and I do enjoy him in the film. It was just hard not to notice this time that the story would basically be essentially the same without him. Like, the character feels like a last-minute addition to the script. I know he wasn't, because so much of it was borrowed from the comics. I'm just saying it feels that way because we learn almost nothing about him. We don't even know why he's a vigilante. He just sort of interrupts an action scene at one point, and then he's just along for the ride. And I'd also argue that his two big moments at the end, well, one of them shouldn't even be in the movie, quite frankly, and the other should have been given to the turtles. But we can get into all that business later. But so him and Raphael get in a fight over who gets to take out these punks that stole a lady's purse. The thugs get away. Casey gets away. And what I'd never realized until this time is that I'm not sure Raph gets to be so self-righteous about all this, because Casey says, you know, these guys need to be taught a lesson. And like, well, not like that. They don't, Raph says.
Not by you.
What was Raph going to do? Make sure they got some counseling and help them turn their lives around? Like, I'm pretty sure they were both just going to beat these guys senseless. Now, my memory of the comic is that Raph is a more disciplined fighter, whereas Casey's just whacking guys with hockey sticks. But that doesn't play as well in the film, especially when Raph's character arc is learning to control his anger, becoming a more focused fighter, and understanding how to be part of a team. You know, but at this point, he's almost as undisciplined as Casey, so it's just the pot calling the kettle black, right?
I disagree.
Okay.
I think Raph was not going to beat them up. Like, he got the purse back, right? It was a purse or something, right?
That
they stole. He gets it back, and he gives it back to the person. And then Casey Jones comes out, and he chases Casey Jones into the park because he's going to beat up the kids.
No. I think Raph, they run into the park to escape from Raphael. Then Casey Jones shows up. Then Raph catches up and sees Casey about to take these dudes out.
But Raph is stopping. My point is, Raph is stopping Casey Jones from beating them because it's over. Like, he took the thing. They didn't try to fight him. He's not fighting back. He's just getting the purse back. Oh. I think that's the conflict that they originally have, is that he's like, they don't need to be beaten up. They're not trying to fight us. But Casey Jones is trying to punish them for the crime, basically. Whereas I think Raph was trying to leave it like, okay, if you would have tried to fight me, we would have thrown down, but you didn't. So go on your way.
You were saying this encounter, that's ludicrous. You're right about that. I think that's probably what they intended. I still don't think this works very well for me. Just like, it would make more sense if Leonardo were the one that had the conflict with Casey about, like, this is how we handle things and you're doing it wrong. It just seems like Raph is a strange choice for that. Especially when what the movie wants to do is establish Raph as the hothead and the one who still needs to learn to control all this and direct that violence, that anger somewhere else.
I need to say something about Raphael. I think the guy who, or per, I don't know, might have been a woman who was in the Raphael suit
It's a guy. It's the same guy that does the voice, actually. The actor's name is Josh Pace, I think.
Really? It's the same guy who does the voice. Okay, that's interesting. Because yeah. I think that this person is moving way too much. Like, there's, like, hand motions that go with every line that don't need to be there. Mm. Like, Raphael, in particular, is really, like, just... like overly, like it's kind of like the Power Rangers when, you know, the way the Power Rangers used to move when they would talk. Like that's how Raphael for me is moving a lot in this movie. And like a lot of like hand gestures and pointing that if this was a silent film would make more sense. Or if like I thought it was a different actor in the suit than it was doing the voice. If it was someone who was just in the suit who didn't quite make the connection that this character is going to have a voice. Like, that's what it felt like. He was trying to demonstrate things with his arms that, like, were going to be demonstrated with vocal talent.
So there were a couple of moments with Raphael specifically where I found myself thinking, like, I actually really like what the guy in the suit is doing. But it was a more of, like, the heightened moments where he's having an argument with Leo or something where it's like he's all worked up. So I haven't noticed what you're saying, but I'm pretty sure that every time I watch this movie now, I'm going to be fixated on that.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
He's just so angry.
Well, and Carlos, you were saying earlier that this encounter doesn't make any sense because it's like, yeah, what is Casey? We're led to believe Casey thinks this is a punk rocker with a shaved head who's painted himself green. And it's like, this is clearly not a human being.
What are you, some kind of punker? Some kind of punker with bald head and green skin who wears ugly masks? Like, seriously, that's what you're telling yourself right now?
Yeah, like, it is.
You know, weird. I didn't even really hear any of that conversation that happened. I was really distracted by Casey Jones's dance belt and sweatpants, if I could just be.
The sweatpants. I was going to say this later. Is anybody else bothered by the fact that Casey Jones wears sweatpants? The same sweatpants for the entire movie, BT dubs.
BT dubs.
There's some assets that are featured that I'm not mad about, but it's distracting.
I think he wears sweatpants in the comic, but there are versions of him sans sweatpants, you know,
what
with something else, not just like his big old dick flopping around, but like that I think those designs work a little bit better. The sweatpants are a strange choice. I mean, I get it. You want to be comfortable. You want to have nice range of motion, but maybe some nice Adidas pants.
I like their exchange when he pulls out the cricket. Bat? I guess it's a cricket bat.
Oh, yeah.
Cricket? You don't understand. Cricket.
It is.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Raphael's the only one who sounds like he's from New York.
Yeah. It's a bummer that they changed the voice in the next two movies.
Yes, that's true.
And Okay, so, speaking of Raph's anger, the next thing we see is him returning home where Splinter's waiting for him. And this, I think, is the first of several surprisingly moving scenes, especially when you realize you're just watching two puppets. Like, it's not on the waterfront, but it's more than most people probably expected from a Ninja Turtles movie. And I love that. I love that they respected their audience, even though that they, you know, they knew it was mostly going to be 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, whatever. I mean, the film delivers what kids came to see, but it also throws in some really nice messages. And some of these quieter scenes wind up being some of the more memorable stuff in the movie. I mean, I don't know. Well, how did you guys respond to these moments as kids? Were you bored between the action beats, or were you guys sort of into this stuff?
Oh, I was wrapped up in the characters. The color bands really did help me identify, honestly.
Okay, the red one.
The emotions and, you know, it was an easy reference point always in childhood. But I was fully wrapped up in the characters, what they were going through. I loved that stuff. All the emotional Splinter. I'm sure I shed a tear at least a couple times in this movie.
Splinter really they really put him through the ringer in this one.
Oh my God.
Poor old rat mouse.
Oh, that old rat mouse.
Do you know why he's... the old rat mouse, you?
I don't know if you guys, Carlos, but if you know why he's named Splinter, but it's actually a reference to Daredevil had that mentor, the Stick.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Stick becomes Splinter. These
guys
are really
big
fans of.
Yeah, they're huge fans of Daredevil.
Yeah.
And actually, it is part of the Ninja Turtle comic book canon that the ooze that mutates them.
Yes.
Is from the same.
This is part of my two truths, one lie.
Oh, well.
It's okay.
Another,
it's okay.
Find another truth, my friend. Yeah, the ooze, the whole accident that leads to their mutation is the exact same accident that leads to Daredevil getting his magic blind powers.
Daredevil gets hit in the face with the canister. The ooze blinds him. That same canister then rolls into the sewer and lands next to four turtles.
Yep. That very same day?
The
very same canister.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be like if Jor-El sent his son from Krypton as it exploded, and then a Kryptonian meteor killed Thomas and Martha Wayne.
Wow.
I mean, I know I really enjoyed all this stuff as a kid, too. I think it's probably one of the many reasons that the first one always felt like a better film than the next two. And I think I was a little bummed out that, again, Leo and Raph were the focus, because Michelangelo is my favorite turtle, and Donatello was probably my second. Yeah, I know. Leonardo is not one you hear mentioned often.
Yeah, like, that's like liking Cyclops.
I did like Shut Cyclops.
Well, you are both weird.
I know. I was never that into Wolverine. I'm a real weirdo. But it's like, yeah, when you were kids on the playground picking, you know, which Ninja Turtle you were going to be, Leonardo was like the one that was like, okay, we all picked already, so you got to be Leo.
Yes, that's true.
Double swords, dude.
But I will say, after watching this movie, though, like, if Raphael is not your favorite Ninja Turtle,
he's
amazing.
Yeah, the emphasis is all on Raph. He definitely is the most interesting one in this film.
Yeah.
There's a nice scene right after this where April's boss, Charles, comes to see her. He's got his son Danny with him. Danny's a bit of a delinquent with his, you know, smart-ass attitude and Sid Vicious t-shirts. And I know this is probably a weird scene to highlight. I just really liked the performances here. And to me, it showed that – it just really hammers home that if any of these actors were embarrassed that they were in this movie, it does not show at all.
Can we talk about, like, the Foot Clan? So their big crime wave is stealing wallets and televisions?
Among other things.
Like,
but
it's like, well, I thought thousands.
But like all of, isn't a lot of that also in service of, you know, that like giant playground they have for all the kids?
That looks like a fun place.
I guess we never get like a sense of what they're quote unquote really doing, right? Because they're not really doing anything. They're just stealing,
I think it is. I think the idea,
a lot of property.
The idea is that the theft sort of facilitates like their operation. That's how they get by. I don't know. Yeah, there isn't a sense of like a larger plan.
Yeah, because like, what is their operation? Are they just paying like for Shredder's property taxes? Like,
I enjoy the fact that there's no take over the city scheme or any of that. I like that they keep it very street level in that sense. But to me, I just took it the same way that any other mob or criminal syndicate operates. There's no giant scheme. It's just we're a criminal syndicate. This is what we do. This is how we survive.
Take shit.
I just thought it was interesting that like this is, you know, for all intents and purposes, this is a superhero movie with where the big bad, if you will, is essentially a pickpocket. Like, that's essentially what his organization does.
Hmm.
There's no, like, political aspirations. There's no, like, I'm going to blow up Manhattan to buy all the land. That would be ridiculous, but it would be something really.
No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, really all
saying.
It is like, I'm going to take all these mischievous boys and have them steal things. And I mean, that's fine, but it's not – there's nothing bigger than that. Like, you would expect it to be something larger, and it just is not that at all. It never gets there.
That's a good point. And I guess I feel the same way you do about like the lack of stakes in like 80s movies. It's just not something that ever bothered me about this. Like I, But yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing to consider. Like that, yeah, that's true. Where are we at here? April covers the press conference from Chief Stearns, makes a fool of him because she doesn't think he's doing a very good job of following through on investigating what's behind this crime wave. We get our first glimpse of Shredder here. He's watching the report and tells his men to find her and silence her. And he's shot like Dr. Claw in this movie. Oh, you know what? That's a reference I feel like I've made before. What other movie did we watch where the villain reveal was framed like this? Adventures in Babysitting.
It wasn't Hook. It might have been Hook.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, so the Foot Clan confronts April in the subway, and the guy who slaps her is apparently the dude who plays Donatello, not Corey Feldman, showing an iota of range for once in his life. the guy who wears the Donatello suit. Although, you know what? Corey Feldman is so up his own ass at this point, he's basically a puppeteer too.
Oh, Feldman burn.
Come at us, Feldman.
There are two things I love about this scene. The first is that April fights back right away. And it's not even like a damsel in distress thing that she's like, I mean, not only is she outnumbered, but they're fucking ninjas. She doesn't have a chance here. So she holds her own as long as she can, which is great. And then Raphael has to rush in and save her. And that's the second thing that I really love is that the shot from his point of view as he's screaming and running towards all of them. Man, that is awesome.
Yeah. She also lets off a semi-racist comment before, so that she's like, what happened? Was I late on my Sony payments?
Oh, that joke is fucking terrible. That's like, and you're right.
What is a Sony payment, first of all? Like, if you don't pay your Sony payments, we're going to send a team of ninjas to kill you.
I hate that moment.
It's
sucks.
A bad joke.
I hate that line.
Lame. Yeah.
So Raph saves April, takes her to the lair, but he doesn't realize that one of the Foot Clan members has followed him. I know they're not technically the Foot Clan in this. That's from the cartoon. But it just feels weird to say, like, one of the Foot follows him. So I'm probably going to keep saying Foot Clan.
That's fine.
Save your emails, nerds. I'm so angry.
And Corey Feldman.
Corey Feldman's not listening to that. Corey Feldman might listen to this.
Corey, you can just email me.
He's got a Google alert. Corey Feldman's definitely a guy that has a Google alert for his name.
He certainly does.
I'm just gonna have to leave it out of the description.
I say put it in. Maybe he tweets about us.
Oh,
he'll
sure.
Be our
yeah.
friend. We'll get Corey Feldman in here.
I've said such wonderful things about him. How do you puppet from inside your own ass, Corey Feldman? So April comes to and understandably starts freaking out. Splinter calms her down and tells her their story. And I really appreciate the way this is handled. Like, this is just better storytelling than some of the other films we've looked at. Like, there's no prologue about how they became Ninja Turtles. We find out when April does. And not only that, but we don't even get the full story yet. Like, you know, the reason Splinter winds up in New York isn't revealed until much later. And that just feels so much better. Like, don't give us four. Give us two here and two over there and let us add it up and put it together on our own.
I also like the black backgrounds whenever Splinter tells a background story.
Sure. Yeah, that's also a really cool touch.
Yeah, well, like later on when he tells the other part of the prologue, it also goes like you can actually see it fade into the black background.
Yeah, it's really striking. You're right. That's a really cool effect. So the Turtles walk April home and we see that she lives above this antique store. And I don't know how familiar you guys are with The Crow, but this was shot at the same studio in Wilmington, North Carolina, the same back lot. And there are a lot of scenes where you can tell. And I'm almost positive that the outside of April's apartment is also Eric and Shelley's apartment in The Crow. They just added that giant circular window to the front of it.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
And, you know what? Actually, Super Mario Brothers was shot here, too.
No way.
Yeah, a lot of this back lot was used for a lot of that, too.
No, Super Mario Brothers was shot in Dinohattan.
Yeah.
On location, you're right. Yeah, yeah. The fucking port. Well, maybe the Manhattan, the New York stuff was shot on the back lot. And then, you know, they did location work in Dino Hatton.
Right, right.
Through a portal, I think that's probably
how it broke down. Actually, I'm just remembering this. The director of this movie is the one who told the producer of The Crow that you should shoot in North Carolina. Like, that's where it's much cheaper. It's non-union. That's where you want to be. So,
oh, God, that's the worst mistake they could have made. Hmm. Because it was the fact that they were non-union is what led to Brandon Lee's death.
That's part of it. Yeah.
They sent home the guy who was in charge of the guns, and they
It's not just that. It's that it was a very young kid who should not have been a props master in the first place.
Right. Like, probably wouldn't have been union.
Right. You're right.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
So it's also the reason Leonardo was killed during the making of this film. So, you know, April says, all I have to offer you is frozen pizza. And that way Michelangelo springs up, it still makes me laugh. That part's fucking hysterical. let's go for it. So the turtles hang out with her for a while. And I know you were sort of, we were, you know, maybe, Carlos, you were saying that the guy inside the Raphael suit has a tendency to sort of overact. I would say for, you know, watch this scene again just to admire how incredible the performers in these suits can be, like how distinctly and differently each turtle moves and eats and all of that. Like, and especially Raphael's body language in this scene. Like, the guys in these suits are just so talented. Like, that really stuck out to me in this moment. So they return to the lair. They see that it's been broken into. The place is trashed. Splinter's gone. They have to return to April's. Leonardo has his Lorne Michaels moment. There's some more stuff with Charles and Danny here. Chief Stearns has pressured Charles to kick April off of this crime wave story in exchange for releasing Danny from custody.
And need to know why this woman's boss is coming over to her apartment in the morning before work all of the time with his son.
They're totally banging.
All of the time.
On the regular. You didn't get that?
They're banging on the reg.
Like they are. But it weirds me out. I don't think they are.
No, they're not fucking with you.
They're not.
Coming over. He's like, good morning, April. I see you're brushing your teeth. Let's discuss this job of yours.
Well, I think I buy
He's her father, Donna.
It's weird.
I don't think it's that weird in this particular moment just because, you know, Stearns calls him and says, if you want, you know, I'll release Danny, but you got to do this for me. And so this is a very immediate sort of he probably just picked Danny up at the police station.
Yeah. But they're over there all the time.
You're right. They are. Yeah. Well, and Danny sees Michelangelo hiding under the kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And God damn it, Mikey, you're a ninja, for Christ's sake. What are you doing under the table?
Did he see a giant turtle or just a stuffed panda?
Oh, silly kids and their drugs. He doesn't know.
But if you look at the writing here, awkward shoehorning in of Casey Jones aside, I do think this is a pretty tight script. And I'm not sure a lot of people even appreciate this because they make it look so easy. But just simple stuff like the Foot Clan finding out where the lair is and the turtles not being there when they show up, Danny seeing Michael under the table and therefore being able to tell Shredder where they're hiding out. I mean, that's this movie top to bottom. It's cause and effect, setup, payoff. And they just make it seem so effortless and so straightforward. I don't know. I really liked all that. And
the moment that leads up, though, to Danny telling the Shredder where they are is like a montage or whatever of him listening to, like, Splinter's advice for him, right? Isn't it like all fathers love their sons or whatever?
No. That comes after.
Okay. That's a different moment. Okay.
Because what happens after this is Danny is – he runs out of the car when his dad tries to take him to school. And then this is where we see how Shredder's operation really works. This is the first time we go inside that warehouse and see that it's just this giant playground for kids. Anything you could possibly want or need, it's right there. And this idea that, you know, you seduce them with all this stuff and then gradually recruit them into the Foot Clan and start giving them more serious training. I think this is a great idea. I think it's one of my favorite aspects of this movie. It's this really, you know, dark and interesting notion. And they didn't even have to do this. The Foot Clan could have just been these anonymous henchmen like in every other movie with a supervillain. The fact that this is established is just so I don't know, man. I really like this idea.
Yeah, I like it too. Like take all of the like wayward boys and turn them into one giant super gang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Shredder summons all of them, and this is one of my favorite scenes as a kid, the build up to our first good look at this guy, and like it's so good. This is still my favorite version of Shredder, and even though it's not, look, I mean, obviously it's not on par with, you know, something like Darth Vader, there's a lot of similar elements here. You know, the helmet, the voice, the way other characters react to him, both are pretty, yeah, they're both pretty much defined by their costume. And I'm talking about the first Star Wars movie. So again, save your emails about the tragic backstory, blah, blah, blah. Pfft, I get it. The costume and the voice define him in that first one. And it's the same thing for Shredder here. And this is also right around the point where I realized, like, I know every line in this movie, because as soon as he started his "money cannot buy the honor which you have earned tonight," like that whole speech, I was like mouthing the words. And then I kind of kept doing that for most of the movie.
And then you found yourself like bleeding from your nose. And you're like, what is happening to me?
I can't, just rocking in my chair. You dirty rat.
Your eyes became very sensitive to light. I can see it. Like, your hair started falling out.
Just pull, yeah. But, like, this is a great moment. And I know I say this a lot, but kids' movies need to stop being so afraid of stuff like this. Like, bad guys, they should be scary. You should feel like the turtles are up against insurmountable odds. So, what do you guys think of Shredder? How does this stuff hold up for you?
I think Shredder is awesome. No, I do. This version of Shredder is pretty scary. I think when I think of Shredder, I still am picturing the cartoon Shredder.
Well, Carlos, what about you? Shredder still works for you? No?
Okay, so Shredder works for me. Like, I would say like 95% Shredder works for me. When he walks into that room and he's wearing the cape, that's awesome. But then there's that like awkward moment where his henchman has to like roll back his cape so that his shoulder pads can. Yeah. It's like, why didn't they just design it so that they were already showing?
I kind of like how ceremonial that is, and just the build up to all of this before
he starts totally
speaking.
Fair. Yeah, that's totally fair. But the I would say the only thing I had a problem with the costume is that his head is so far into that helmet. Like, it's such a big helmet for his head that I feel like a lot of his face is like, the part where he takes the mask away later on, like his head looks so small in that helmet. I didn't like whatever, and this is just me being prissy. I didn't like whatever material was making up his actual like clothing for his
body. Oh, I kind of dig that. I like the way that shows up on camera. I think it's got a really interesting texture to it.
I thought it looked kind of cheap.
Oh, I don't know. I to me it seemed like something you would still be able to like move around in, especially if he also, you know, like when he's doing his martial arts stuff later. Yeah. The thing about the helmet, the fact that it's so big, the one thing I would change about this is either hire an actor who has a little bit more intimidating a stature, because the helmet does you do get a little bit of the Lord Helmet effect going on in this.
Yeah, he's kind of swimming in that helmet.
Yeah.
A little bit. Just a little. I mean, it's still a great performance, and he's still, like, incredibly intimidating on screen, but he's kind of swimming in that helmet.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Shit. There's another thing I'm going to fixate on. But the other thing he says here that I wanted to touch on was the stuff about how these kids are there because the outside world rejects them. And I enjoy stories where hero and villain are different sides of the same coin, because what you have here are the turtles who can't go out into the world as themselves. They have to stay hidden and secret. Splinter is their father who instills a sense of morality and honor in them. And Shredder also declares that he is the father of these lost kids, but he's teaching very different, very corrupt lessons. He has his own code of honor, but it's very different than Splinter's. And a lot of this winds up being about family, you know, this bond that holds the turtles together and them learning to work with each other without their mentor. And then, you know, over here, you've got Shredder's very twisted version of family, the recognition of which is like that winds up being part of his undoing. And that's something that was never in the cartoon or in the comic. And I like that
the kids about like the world rejects them and he's their father and whatever, that they're all a family. It rang so true of like what every DARE program in the 90s said, like gangs would try to get you to do to join a gang. Like they would tell you that they're your family. It's like, oh, he's just a really big gang
yeah,
leader.
That's a good point.
Get it. But I never put that together for Splinter, even though he was telling the turtles the same thing.
Well, and we see that, you know, Splinter is there chained up and he hears Shredder making this speech and saying that he's going after these turtles. And then so that's when Danny steps forward to Shredder, because as previously mentioned that, you know, he knows where to find them. Then we see April on TV completely betraying her boss's orders and revealing the identity of the Foot. You know, this crime syndicate can be traced back to ninja thieves who were once active in Japan. And I don't know if you guys caught this. The reporter she's talking to here is June. Later on, she'll reference another reporter named May. So April, May, June.
Oh, shit.
Leonardo and Raphael get into a fight about what their next move should be. Raph goes up to the roof. Casey is on another rooftop and sees him. And I thought there was sort of a missed opportunity here to have Casey looking through the binoculars and see the Foot Clan closing in on Raph. And I mean, that's what we're left to that's what we're left to presume happens. I just thought that that would have been a cool shot. Casey shouting a warning to Raph that he obviously can't hear, and then, you know, taking off and trying to get to him on time.
What was he doing up there?
Looking for crime, damn it.
I guess. What a guy.
Now we get the big action sequence of the Foot Clan pouring into April's apartment. Raphael's been critically injured, so not only are they wildly outnumbered, they're also down a man. And this whole thing starts off with Michelangelo and one of the Foot Clan members having a nunchuck duel. And this wasn't in some of the international cuts of the movie. Like, some countries had banned nunchucks. And so there are cuts of this where they've been completely removed. And they did the same thing with the cartoon. In fact, by season 4, I think you barely saw them. Michelangelo started using some sort of grappling hook instead. Like, these nunchucks were always a real point of controversy, which is so strange. Probably, maybe they're easier to get, you know, your hands on a pair of those than some double swords.
Well, I feel like, yeah, everybody loved the nunchucks. I don't think a vast portion of my peers and I had not seen nunchucks before this. Mm-hmm. And they were so cool. And I remember, I mean, there's no way you're going to go home with two swords, but you can kind of sneak nunchucks in, I feel like. You know?
Did you guys ever try making your own?
Oh, it's just terrible. You really hurt yourself. Yeah. It's really... That's that, why
see,
I
that's
thought
there
it was
controversial. There it is. That's why they were banned.
A bunch of dumb, uncoordinated kids are like, look, nunchucks, ow!
Flinging soda cans around with fucking yes. soda cans and rubber bands.
And there's like...
Do you have good nunchuck skills?
Spits coming from it. Yeah.
But
a hard skill.
What's funny is that while this is happening, while these two guys are Michelangelo's dueling with this guy, all the other guys are just standing there like, hey, Dave, can you show off later? We're on the clock here. It's just and so this movie is made in 1990. It's 2014. I cannot believe the Wheel of Fortune reference is still relevant.
Oh, my God. It's amazing.
It's. Do you guys remember when they tried to do a sexier version of like Wheel of Fortune After Dark? Do you remember this? And it came on late. So it would come on twice. You'd get the normal version at like 5:30, whatever. And then late at night, there was like a sexy Wheel of Fortune with like
what does
a young,
that mean?
Like a younger host, and there were a lot, and all the girls wore like super revealing clothing.
That's awesome.
And it didn't. Well, the reason I know it exists is the first Playboy I had given to me, one of the girls from Sexy Wheel of Fortune was like, you know, she had a photo spread and she was talking about the show. That's the only reason I know it exists.
That's funny.
Sexy Lord. Wheel of
Fortune. You know what? What kept coming into my mind during this fight scene, this whole fight scene, is Leonardo could kill all of them and
right?
should.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he has two katanas.
Well, I think that's why they're robots in the cartoon, is they can be so much more vicious with like ripping those things apart.
Yeah, they rip their heads off.
And like, yeah, Donatello would jam his staff like through a head and stuff, but it just sparks, so it's fine.
Yeah, but like Leonardo and all of the fight sequences, like it's super awkward because Leonardo should be impaling them.
Yeah.
But he's not.
Yeah. I was going to bring up, I love his double swords, but in this particular instance, he's really not that good at double sword. which, in fairness, it's really hard. They're both two heavy swords, and you got to have a dominant arm. So one of them is really, it's tough. But he does not do a great job.
Well, I think what's great about this sequence is that it keeps escalating. Like, first, more and more guys keep coming in. And then at one point, they bring in axes. And then, so that leads them, like, they wind up falling through the floor. And then the building catches fire. And it keeps upping the stakes and the tension. And at a certain point, the music even shifts from being kind of fun and up-tempo to being more serious and dire. Like, okay, it was fun and games for a while, but now we really need to get the fuck out of here. And, like, and then that's right around the point where Casey shows up and he holds off the Foot Clan while the Turtles and April make their escape. He hears Charles fire April over her answering machine just before he ducks out. And then the last thing we see is Danny on another rooftop watching this building burn and knowing that it's all because of him. And the Turtles hide out at April's old farmhouse. This is where I made the note about Casey Jones' sweatpants. This is where it really starts to bother me because they got to be so stinky at this point, too. all that fighting and sweating and just
fire.
He is
dirty.
Mm-hmm.
He tells April she's been fired, and the argument that follows, my sister and I used to reenact this. Like when we were 8 and 6 years old, she'd be shouting at me, "What did you do? Take classes in sensitivity?" And we'd slam doors and everything. And there was one weekend at my grandparents where my grandma was very concerned that we were really going at it. And it's like, yeah, your grandchildren are the most articulate and quippy children to ever exist outside of a Joss Whedon show. That's what's happening here. But so I remembered this section of the film being longer, and I was pleasantly surprised that it's fairly brief. Like each turtle is sort of dealing with this first defeat in his own way, the most significant of which is Leonardo blaming himself for what happened to Raphael. And it's really sweet that he's just sitting there with Raph waiting for him to wake up. But the way they just tossed this dude into the tub looks horrific.
It's very happy.
Like, just the way he's positioned is so much more comical than I remembered.
All I could think of in this scene was like, why isn't he in a bed?
I thought maybe they were trying to make him comfortable and more of like a – but you're – I mean, yeah, it's fucking hard porcelain. There's no way he's –
he's like half hanging out of it. There's nothing comfortable about that.
Yeah.
That's silly.
Oh, my God.
I also like how they just randomly introduced that April is a really good drawer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty random. That is a running theme with some of these movies, Harry and the Hendersons.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was another one where – oh shoot! There's
Sue
another
Ellen
one.
Can draw.
Oh,
Sue
maybe.
From Don't
yeah.
Tell Mom the Babysitter.
This
is draws all that.
This
fashion.
Was just a thing. This is just the second act reveal that like, ta da! I'm amazing.
Like, oh, by the way, I'm also really good at sketching things, especially giant turtle people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so Ralph.
wait, real quick before we move on, because you're about to say Raph, but. What was Michelangelo going through?
They definitely cut like, that part out.
Yeah, because she's like, Leonardo is sitting by his, you know, by his bath side every day.
Donatello and Casey Jones
are you know, bonding. Michelangelo, was he getting high? What was happening to him?
He was secretly fine with it.
He's just, yeah, he's baked by the TV with the pizza. He didn't care.
Yeah,
he was like, whatever.
Voiced, no, he wasn't voiced by Corey Feldman. Never mind.
Let me know when we're ready, and I'll get up and go. But
yeah.
Oh, is he up?
He's
oh,
like,
great.
He'll be fine.
Who's Ralph? Is what he was. But so, Raph. Not Ralph, Raph.
Ralph.
King Ralph, John Goodman, wakes up from the bathtub. The movie takes a really strange turn.
Ralph Macchio wakes up from the bathtub.
Ralph Macchio wakes up. The turtles, like, they refocus. They take their training up a notch, you know, now that they've regrouped. And this sequence ends with Raphael shouting Splinter from the rooftop. And that's a little much. It's,
it's weird.
That's a streetcar named Miss Fire is what that is. <That's>, so now we get the one scene I'd take out if I had my way. Leo meditates, somehow establishes a connection to Splinter, who calls out to him. Leo then gathers all the other turtles so that they can all meditate together. And I love when Donatello busts out the marshmallows to roast on the fire, and Leo tells him, you know, I'll put that away. Yeah, Donnie, put those flaming marshmallows right there in that dead bush and all that dry grass right behind you. Set them right there. But yeah, so but Splinter appears in the fire and tells them, oh, you've learned your final lesson, blah, blah, blah. I love you all. Look, I know it's a movie about talking turtles, but play by the rules you've established. Like, this scene always seemed a little strange to me. Like, if you want them to meditate and come to the conclusion that it's time to set aside their fear and come home, then fine. I actually love the idea of showing that their training has been about more than fighting. But this mystical vision nonsense really stands out. Like, even in a movie with radioactive ooze and a giant rat, I always thought this was a little weird. But no, you guys are fine with Splinter's spirit appearing in the fire.
Yeah, I kind of liked it.
A turtle seance.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
He's like saying goodbye to them too, right? Like, he's like, this is your last lesson and catch you later, suckers.
Yeah, peace out.
Yeah.
It's a very informal way. Yes.
Yeah.
So they all return to the lair, and they find Danny hiding out there. And this is missing the moment where he admits that this is all his fault and apologizes to them. Unless it's there. Like, did I miss that? Because I know he repays April the money he stole from her purse, like, at the end of the movie. But that's sort of small potatoes when you're the reason her home went up in flames. Here's the $20 I owe you. Sorry about your apartment. This is where we find out Casey's claustrophobic, and there's that awkward joke about him thinking that means that they're calling him gay.
Yeah.
That reminds me of, so I was at my mom's place on Christmas, and we were getting ready to go over to my sister's, but she had warned us that her kids were really sick. So my mom starts busting out these airborne pills and, you know, something else. And my stepdad tells Kristen and I that this certain brand is really great because they're homophobic. And we looked at each other like, wait, what? And it turns out he meant homeopathic. But yeah, pop a few of these if you want to have a sudden aversion to gay marriage. So Casey goes to sleep in the truck.
Aren't they like Duck Dynasty brand?
Yeah, exactly. Casey goes to sleep in the truck. He sees Danny sneaking out in the middle of the night, follows him back to the warehouse, and Casey does the fastest costume switcheroo ever to get into a Foot Clan outfit and infiltrate the place. Like, I mean, he knocks the dude out and then just stands right up, isn't all right, here I am. Danny returns to Splinter. This is where Splinter reveals the full origin story. He was in Japan with his master, Hamato Yoshi. The mimicking, the fighting moves from the cage, this is probably the most ridiculous couple of seconds in the entire movie. This got a big laugh in the theater.
He's not a mutant rat. He's just a rat.
He does not have the capacity to practice ninjutsu.
Thank you.
It doesn't make any sense. The other version of the origin is a little easier to digest. But anyway, so Yoshi's rival is this guy, Iruku Saki. They're both in love with the same woman. Yoshi travels to America with her to escape Saki, but he follows them, murders them both. Splinter gets knocked out of his cage, attacks this guy slashes at his face. He cuts off part of Splinter's ear and escapes. And Splinter retreats to the sewer not long after, stumbling across these four turtles, on and on and on. So Danny asks, well, whatever happened to this Urukusaki guy? And Splinter says he doesn't know, but he mentions that Danny is wearing his symbol on his brow. And so obviously Urukusaki is Shredder. Like, Splinter seems to have already figured it out, even though he just doesn't come right out and say it. Shredder catches them. And he sees that Danny has one of April's drawings. That's how he knows the turtles are back. Orders Tatsu, you know, kill the rat. I'm going after the turtles myself this time. There's no more room for mistakes. So the Foot Clan, they invade the lair a second time, but now the turtles are ready for them. And while that's going on, Casey finds Danny. The two of them go to get Splinter out of there. And Casey's reaction to Splinter is so great. It's just like, oh, shit. Okay, whatever. That makes sense. Based on everything I've seen the past few days, sure. And so Tatsu tries to stop them. Casey knocks him out with a golf club. All the street kids try to stand their ground, but Splinter and Casey call out this twisted version of a family of theirs. And now, okay, I love most of this movie. I mean, I enjoy all of it. I do. But this is something that always bugged me about this and, quite frankly, all of these the live-action Turtles movies. They are never the ones to save the day. Someone else always does it for them. This movie was about them learning to work as a team so they could go rescue their mentor and bring down Shredder. They do neither of those things. The whole climax, it should have been them showing up at Shredder's doorstep ready for this final confrontation. They really needed to be the ones to save Splinter and take on this group of misguided kids and set them straight. Casey has no emotional connection to Splinter. He's never even heard of him. And then, like, you know, so the battle, it spills into the streets of New York. The turtles wind up on the roof with Shredder. They don't beat him. It's not even close. You know, they each take a shot, and he's about to straight up murder Leonardo until Splinter arrives to bail them out. Splinter throws Shredder over the roof. Casey crushes him in the garbage truck. The turtles play no part in it. It's the same problem I had with the Sandlot. This is their story. They have to be the ones to complete this journey, and they aren't. And, let's talk about Shredder's death, like both as the resolution of the film and as Casey's last big moment. So I remember my stepdad walking into the room when I was watching this one time, and it was right at the part where Shredder gets crushed, and he was like, Jesus. And yeah, like, these are the good guys, right? Like, this doesn't seem like the way they'd wrap this up. And also, I have to ask again, what is the point of Casey Jones here? Because what are we meant to take away from his first scene with Raphael? That his heart's in the right place, but he still has a lot to learn. Like, he's a little too bloodthirsty, not as disciplined. So what has he learned from hanging out with the turtles? Fucking nothing. He was more interested in flirting with April. I mean, he makes a joke about murdering a dude and then goes and makes out with this chick. So I really am not crazy about the way they tie all this stuff up. I don't know. Am I alone in this? Is it fine for you guys?
No.
It's a little silly. I think this is just a way, it seemed like watching Indiana, it's like, this is just a way so that the turtles kind of don't have blood on their hands.
Right.
Just so, you know, when parents are like, oh, they killed that nice Shredder man. You'd be like, no, actually, Casey Jones killed Shredder.
They didn't double sword him. Anybody. They didn't, there was no ninjaing of the Shredder. It was Casey Jones.
Tired by that time, like breathing hard on the roof.
But see, that's part of the problem too, is like, even killing Shredder is sort of, it's maybe if that's the issue, we don't want it, the turtles to have blood on their hands. Well, then maybe don't murder this dude.
yeah, you could just defeat him.
So, Carlos, you felt the same way? This doesn't quite work for you?
Yeah, no, there's a point here where it very easily could have gone in the Tim Burton Batman way, like, you know, Joker just falls to his death.
Especially because if Splinter had not been making the speech about death and about dying an honorable death, then it looks like you're exactly right, that he's holding him there, and the reason he falls is because he throws the knife at Splinter.
Right.
Splinter dodges that, and that's why he lets him go. That should have been it.
Yeah, he should have just fallen to his death.
There's no reason to crush him
in a dumpster. But it was almost like they were just like, yeah, he's not coming back for the sequel. except that he comes back for the
totally
sequel.
Totally coming back.
Yeah.
So April gets her job back. And I like, she tells Charles, because she keeps saying, well, I want a bigger office. You got it. And I want this. You got it. And she goes, you're a tough negotiator, Charles. If tough means agreeing to every demand, then yeah, he's fucking ruthless. And then so her and Casey have their big kiss. The turtles practice the art of invincibility by shouting from the rooftop in front of the cops and everyone else. And then the last moment is them trying to decide on the perfect word to celebrate their victory. And only one will do who wants to say it.
Cowabunga!
T-U-R-D-L-E power.
I made a funny!
T-U-R-D-L-E power. And then we should just Swede the entire movie. You guys want to start over and just do Ninja Turtles?
I lost a sigh.
I can get it back. I can get it back. So I listened to that entire song over the end credits, just straight up like dancing in my chair, mouthing all the words.
Is that that's the song that claims that Raphael is the leader of the group, is it not?
Yeah, they didn't even watch the movie. It's like they're turtles. They fly around in their spaceships. They shoot fucking bugs.
Oh, that's what Michael Bay's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what? I did not listen to that song the last time I saw the movie, but I definitely remember the stanza, pizza's the food that's sure to please. These ninjas are into pepperoni and cheese. And then it's like, back to the story. It's not hard to find. It's like, you're just admitting that you went on a weird tangent there.
Well, there's also a weird line about, like, in a field of weeds, you know, they pick a flower because they got turtle power. What? They're fucking gardeners? Oh, man.
Evil moves fast, but good moves faster than light. No, they actually had a really hard time finding Shredder. We should do a whole podcast just about that song.
We could, yeah. Okay, so final thoughts on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Donna.
This movie is awesome. It's amazing to see the huge level that this franchise has grown to. But, you know, going back to this first movie that came out, that feeling kind of does rekindle in you, and you really feel... Yeah, Chris, you said it earlier that we're lucky to have this movie... kind of pay off in all the right places, and it's a really great story to tell, so watch it and be awesome.
Carlos?
I think this is definitely the best iteration of the Ninja Turtles that I've ever experienced. And I think, I mean, there are some very nitpicky problems with it. Like, personally, I don't think that the Casey Jones, April O'Neil relationship was earned at all. But, that's not a huge deal for me. Yeah, this movie is amazing, especially when you consider, like, when it was made and how there are very few, like, computer generated images going on here. It's all it's all puppets, and it's, you know, you feel emotions for puppets.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that Roger Ebert's review of this was that it was poo-poo to the max. That is such an inside joke. The listeners, they're going to love that.
That means good.
Good. It means
that
good.
Means good.
Yeah, that's the weird twist. Poo-poo to the max actually means it's great. That's how we say we like things.
The best.
So, but it is. So Ninja Turtles is poo-poo to the max, and that's high praise. So
Ebert actually say that it was poo-poo to the max? Like, did he say it was good?
No, his review, it was pretty middle of the road. I think it was 2.5 stars. And he said that all of its shortcomings aside, this was probably the best Ninja Turtles movie that could have been made. And he meant that more cynically, obviously. But I echo that statement. I think it's a perfect blend of the turtles' grittier origins with, you know, some of the more lighthearted elements of the cartoon. It delivers the kind of movie we all hoped to see when we went into the theaters. And it also brings new things out of the material and puts its own spin on the mythology, sometimes more successfully than, you know, in other places. But I don't know. I mean, you know, you can see, like, the limitations of these rubber suits, but I think the action scenes are still well choreographed and exciting. A lot of it is still very funny. Some of it is still surprisingly moving. And you can tell they wanted this to be about something, even if the execution occasionally falls short of their aspirations. I wish the Turtles had taken a more active role in the climax, and I still question the necessity of Casey Jones in this particular story. Feels like maybe a character you want to save for the sequel. But overall, this is still a fun watch, and I feel so fortunate to have been exactly the right age for this when it was released. I strongly doubt there will ever be a better live-action Turtles movie, and how awesome is it that this one was ours? And I also want to mention that if you were a fan of this stuff growing up, do yourself a favor and check out that new Nickelodeon cartoon that just came out a year or two ago. It's shockingly good. Like, I had it on in the background while I was coloring our comic one Saturday, and at a certain point I realized I had stopped what I was doing and was just giving my full attention to it. It's great. Like, Carlos, I know you and I both enjoyed that Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon quite a bit.
Oh, so good.
So, yeah, I would definitely check this out. I think it's a lot of fun.
Sorry, hold on. Have you ever seen Turtles Forever?
I don't like it.
Really?
It completely changes the personalities of, like, the Turtles we grew up with and just turns them into, like, idiots. But, like, the new Turtles have to babysit them.
But that's kind of the joke. It's,
I think they take it too far. I do like when they go back to, like, when they bring in the comic book Turtles.
Yeah, and then everybody just seems like a punk compared to them.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell our listeners, because Chris isn't going to recommend it. Go find and watch Turtles Forever. It's basically an amalgamation of every animated version of the Ninja Turtles.
Up to that point, 2004, yeah, I think.
Clearly, there are no future versions of it.
Awesome.
in that version, in that movie. But they're cognizant of the fact that they're from different universes, and it's really,
right.
I think, really well done and very funny.
It's a great idea. It is a really cool idea.
And I think it's pretty funny. Mm-hmm. I think it's like when the new Turtles see April in the yellow jumpsuit, they're like, April, in this world, are you a plumber? I mean, that's funny. That's good. So, yeah, check that out. That's my probably, honestly, it's probably like either my second or third favorite Ninja Turtles thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, so I know we'll probably do the sequels at some point, at least the second one. But so I don't want to go too much into that. But do you guys remember the live action TV show, The Next Mutation?
I remember.
Where they had Venus de Milo, the girl turtle?
I remember that it existed. I didn't remember. I've never seen it.
I was in high school, so I was a little too old for it. It was like in that Power Rangers vein of it was made very cheaply, and it didn't last long, but I've seen about 2 minutes of it on YouTube. It is horrendous. So do you guys want to play Two Truths, One Lie?
Yeah. Did you change one of the truths?
I'm going to have to, so let's see how this goes. Okay, here we go. Two Truths, One Lie for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'm going to give you two truths and one lie. Okay. Number one. So, Judith Hoag plays April O'Neil in this film, but is replaced by Paige Turco in the subsequent films. However, Turco was the original choice of the producers, but a scheduling conflict prevented her from joining the production. When it came time to shoot the sequel, not even a year later, it was such a rushed production, Judith Hoag was now unavailable, and Turco was the first person they signed for that film. Number two. There is an alternate ending to the film where April and Danny pitch the idea of giant turtles to a comic book publisher. The publisher dismisses the idea as being too far-fetched, and as he speaks, you can see the turtles popping up in the window behind him. Number three, when Raphael is chasing after Casey Jones and gets hit by the cab, the passenger in the cab is the actor that is both inside the suit and the voice of Raphael. Which one is the lie?
I think the third one is the lie. Because I want
the one about the passenger in the
camera. Yeah, I want the other ones to be true.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to say number two is the lie.
The alternate ending.
Yeah, the alternate ending.
The lie was actually number one.
Hmm.
What? what?
The reason April does not, that Judith Hogue does not reprise the role is that apparently a bunch of her scenes were cut from this one. Some of the stuff that she felt were some of April's better moments, which might explain the unearned ending of her and Casey getting together. There's apparently a lot of stuff that didn't make it into the film that she was upset about. So when they offered her the sequel, she said, thanks, but I'm good.
Would you watch it? Would you watch a 2-hour cut of this movie?
I think it's sort of the, I mean, this is another reason I don't think Casey needs to be in there. Devote that screen time to her and the turtles. Mm. I mean, because the romance winds up kind of going nowhere anyways. And you're right, Carlos. No, I think that would be pushing it.
Yeah. Okay.
And then so an explanation of these other things. That alternate ending is absolutely real. You guys can go on YouTube when we're done recording and watch it.
Oh, you can watch it?
Yep, it's on YouTube. Just search for Ninja Turtles alternate ending. It'll pop up.
Wow.
And they hadn't done any sound mixing. The voices of the turtles aren't the voices from the movie. It's the guys that are performing it on set. So it's very, very rough. But that's why she was established as an artist earlier in the film. And then, the guy in the cab is absolutely the actor. That's Josh Pace, the guy that plays Raphael and does the voice.
Wow.
Okay, so, Donna, what time is it?
It's time to play Who Would You Be and Who Would You F?
Okay. Who do we want to guess for first?
This is exciting, right? Did you guys, were you thinking, let me just say this first, were you thinking of doing like an all turtle episode where your answer for both has to be a turtle?
Oh my God. Or
that is definitely not what I was thinking, but if you want to apply those restrictions, it's going to make this a lot more interesting.
There are two women in this film.
Yeah, that's true. So let's, let's do the traditional version, our real answers, and then let's also... Let's tag
answers.
On Donna's restrictions here.
God.
If it has to be turtles.
Turtle time.
So, you know what? This is like straight up bestiality. Is this the weirdest one we've done?
Yeah.
Is this going to be weirder than Natalie Portman in The Professional?
Probably.
I think the weirdest one still is me saying the it's my party and I'll cry if I want to girl from Problem Child.
But the turtles are underage. They're 15.
But so are you. You have to be one of them and F one of them.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
If you're like, if you're like, hey, I'm a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle and I kind of have a thing.
Then it's incest, Donna, which I'm not sure is any better.
No, it's fine.
Okay, so who's going first here?
I'll go.
We're going to guess for Carlos.
Guess for
Carlos.
Me.
Donna, who did you think Carlos wanted to be and F?
Okay, so I thought, in the human version, I thought he would F April.
Yeah.
But I thought for both, I thought he would be Michelangelo.
Okay.
Because nunchucks are awesome and pizza's delicious. He's a fun-loving guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then for which turtle he would... F.
This is so weird.
I think that he would F Raphael because of his passionate energies.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So
what is happening?
I thought Carlos would be Donatello and F April, just because in my mind, thinking of all the different turtles' personalities, maybe, I don't know. Like, if we were playing on the playground as kids, Carlos would be Donatello. But in the all-turtle review, what's happening is he, I guess, is still Donatello and is, oh my God, is effing Raphael. For the same reason Donna said, there's Raphael's got a lot of passion. There's a lot of angry sex is, we're going to stop. Okay. So,
oh God,
Carlos, how'd we do?
Okay, so I would want to be. Actually, you know what? I was gonna say Raphael until you said Donatello, and then I had to really consider that. And I would, I think I would be Donatello because he just seems happier in his life than Raphael. And I would definitely F April. She's the only female really in the movie, other than the woman that Oroku Saki and Hamada Yoshi fight over. And then in the weird turtle game that we're playing here, I would be Raphael because he's given it. He's given it.
Yeah.
That's happening. And I would F Splinter.
That's not fair. You're going to break him.
I will take in his powers as my own.
Oh, no.
He's dead, guys. He's dead now because of that.
Wow.
You just ripped him in half.
Yeah.
That's shitty, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Second choice would be Leonardo because he's the most like a girl.
Oh.
That's true. Oh.
Shit.
Double swords and all. It's still.
Double swords.
Ow.
Okay.
All right.
Do you want to go for Chris now?
Chris Schrader.
Oh, you know what? Speaking of like Shredder, that's what like when kids make fun of your name. I got that a lot, Chris Shredder, and I was like, "Are you nuts? That sounds awesome." I wish my last name was Shredder.
That's awesome.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Okay, Chris wants to be. I'll give Chris Michelangelo, because why not? Because Michelangelo is hilarious and wants to F April, unless we're in weird turtle times. And then he still wants to be Mikey, but he does want to F Leonardo for reasons already mentioned.
Okay.
Well, I said that in the human world, Chris would F April. Duh, this movie's so boring. But then you would be Raphael, because of the, you know, the energy and such. And you would F Michelangelo, because he's fun-loving. Need to relax a little bit.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, human world, be Michelangelo, F April.
Okay.
Interesting that nobody wanted to be Casey Jones. I'm not that surprised. And then in Weird Turtle World, actually, I had a different answer, but Donna, you kind of just convinced me. I hadn't even considered the combination of being Raph and this is so stupid. And effing Michelangelo. And it somehow makes sense in a way that this shouldn't make sense, but it does. Christ. Okay, Donna, I said,
yeah.
Ugh. I said you would be April, not just because she's the woman, but because like she gets to go on this cool adventure with all of them. And also because I do think this is a pretty kick-ass chick. She's funny. She's smart. She tries to hold her own against the Foot Clan in a fight. I think she's pretty cool. And I thought you would F Sam Rockwell in Human World. And then in Turtle World, you want to be Leonardo and F Raphael.
Okay. Carlos?
You want to be Michelangelo and F Casey Jones for realsies. Okay. And then for fakesies, you want to be You want to be Michelangelo again. I'm going to say Michelangelo because I feel like it. And you want to F Donatello because they definitely got a thing going on, right?
Yeah. It's a bromance for sure. Maybe more.
Oh. Well, only one part right. In Human World, I would F Casey Jones. And because those sweatpants fucking speak for themselves.
There's so much funk in there, but okay.
And I'm not going to be proud of it, but like that's who I'm taking home. There's nobody else. I mean, Shredder, come on. Anyway, so in Turtle World, but okay, so my choice overall for the movie would be to be Splinter because I'm sage as shit, yo. I could fight some and mentor some turtles. So I would be Splinter and I would F Donatello, because he's the most reasonable, well-adjusted turtle.
That's fair.
Do you think anybody is still listening right now?
I stopped
listening. As soon as they started talking about fucking turtles, I was out. And I'm pretty sure I'm not ever listening to another episode.
Like,
wait till
like,
we get
oh,
to Homeward
no.
Bound, you guys.
Yikes.
Oh, cat is sassy.
Yikes.
All right.
Oh, good times.
Okay, guys, that's it for us. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, subscribe on iTunes, like our Facebook page to find out what we're looking at next, and to share your own memories of these films. Let us know if you have suggestions for other titles we should revisit, and we'll see you next time.